You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and I'm here sitting with the guys, and let me introduce them for you. We've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
Bobby Summerfield.
Hello.
Rob Arbatier.
Hello there.
And today, as our special guest, we have Morgan Neville.
Good evening.
We're missing Martin, guys, because Martin...
I would not. He's actually...
Martin Page is working right now, so feel free to talk about him as much as you want right now. Either that or Bobby, you can do your best Martin impersonation.
No, won't. We'll let him do that, but...
Okay, Martin, just so you know that off the air, Bobby was doing a great impersonation.
Busted.
Well, before we get going, I just want to introduce Morgan to you guys. Morgan Neville is a director, producer, writer of documentaries, and I've worked on a couple of them as his audio engineer for at least, what, five or six of them?
Yeah, I'd say.
And he's done a ton of music documentaries on well, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the stuff you've done?
Well, running the gamut, you know, everything from, you know, a documentary about the Brill Building and pop songwriting in New York in the 50s and 60s, Lieber and Stoller, Burt Bacharach, you know, songwriter producers, Hank Williams documentary for PBS last year and Muddy Waters the year before that, and Brian Wilson, you know, a lot of
Nelsons.
Music people. I worked on that. I didn't actually direct that.
Oh, okay. Not the Nelsons. Nat, did you work on the Nat King Cole one?
I did, Nat. I did Nat King Cole. I did a Ray Charles project, and I just did a Highwaymen documentary, and I just did a history of women in country music.
Wow.
Too. So kind of all over the map.
So, but. And the other thing too about Morgan, he's really knowledgeable about Los Angeles and LA history, and actually is a huge Tiki fan from what I remember.
That's true. Where's the Mai Tai, Mike?
That's right. So we're going to be talking to Morgan a little bit later. But right now, I want to cover some of the NAB stuff that we talked about in the last podcast. And first of all, Final Cut 6 did not come out at NAB. That was the
big. Pro Tools 8 is coming out though, right?
But didn't Premiere show something new?
A new set of bugs? Kidding.
Everybody showed a little bit of something, but there was nothing earth-shaking or just groundbreaking. As a matter of fact, if people really want to find out what's happening over at NAB and what happened at NAB, they can go to Mix Online because that's just a great place to get all your information. Which reminds me, I wanted to ask you guys, where do you go for information to keep up on technology with press releases and things like that? Rob, do you have a particular place you like to go to?
Actually, I don't. A lot of my friends know I don't actually subscribe to any industry magazines. I go to trade shows. I go to the NAMM show. I go to AES and music stores. But anything that's really a hot product, I'm going to hear about from friends, or if I happen to be in a store, I'm going to hear about it. But I find when I'm thumbing through the magazines, I just find a constant stream of things I can't live without that until I saw the picture, I could live without them fine. And it ends up being really expensive. So I don't actually subscribe to any industry magazines because I worry they're just going to make me spend more than the insane amount I already do.
Of course, you're such a great beta tester too, Rob, that you get the inside on pretty much most of the big stuff that comes out. Anyway.
I enjoy beta testing. I mean, partly to get the scoop on the inside scoop on where things are going, but also I like to be able to put my own ideas into a new product. So beta testing is a cool way to help drive development.
Bobby, you're a beta tester for some products too.
New Windows, Steinberg. Steinberg, sorry.
You know, that's one question I wanted to ask you guys as beta testers. How much responsibilities do you feel when you're beta testing? I mean, do you take that seriously? Like, hey, listen, I really got to make this a really good product for the consumer who's ultimately going to get this.
Well, for me, certainly. I mean, New Windows, for example. I started betaing it when it was 2.something, and it had a lot of horrible mission critical bugs, you know. And I really liked the program, and I wanted to get it going, so I was, you know, adamant and helped as much as I could to, you know, on their BBS all the time shouting at them, saying, hey, this is not working, this is crashing, do you know this, you know that. So I think, yeah, I think all the beta testers, really, there's some knowledgeable guys out there too, and girls, of course. They really have their heart, and they really like doing it, and they don't have a life either, so they really do get...
And I think you'll also find that the best beta testers are basically helping others by helping themselves. I mean, because any bug you find that gets fixed helps you in your own work, aside from all the other people, it's going to help.
It's quite funny as well. You see all the beta testers, you know what land they work in, because there'll be like a whole slew of, from one guy would say, oh, the video's not syncing to my 9-pin or whatever, you know, what app it uses. And some guys would be talking about the MIDI. So some people, you know, it's, you know, programs these days are all pretty large. So there's so many different areas. They do need a lot of people to...
And most of the big manufacturers have gotten their beta programs together. It used to be just a free-for-all, and things weren't kept very organized. But I found now with some of the products that I beta test with big companies, they have good BBS systems or web-based apps for keeping track of things. And
Waves is good at that.
Yeah, the first class they use, yeah.
Have you beta tested any software?
Tons. Part of Rob and I, we were part of a group. They nicknamed us the LA3.
Yeah, we were beta testing a ton of stuff there.
Well, because it was interesting because we all used the exact same gear totally differently. So it was Rob, myself, and a guy named Andrew.
Yeah, I'll give Andrew Sheps some props. Andrew is a great engineer. He just did a bunch of engineering mixing on the new Chili Peppers record.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to bring Andrew in.
We will, one of these weeks.
But it was great because we would all use the gear, and because we used it totally different than each other, a company can actually just drop a, you know, give us all a piece of gear, check it out, or program, and we would take it through its paces in a totally different way. And they would get a lot of bang for the buck that way.
Do you find that companies that beta test really well, do you find them to be the companies that financially are reaping the rewards? I mean, when you look at your products that you've beta tested, do you know any products that, well, they put a lot into beta testing and then it hasn't paid off? I would imagine generally it would pay off.
No, I've never seen really good organized beta testing not pay off.
Occasionally, I think some beta testing goes either one of two ways. They either want to know what you think of the product and how to make it better, or they give you the product to see if you like it. So it's kind of a semi-beta. And then you have questions like, well, you know, you should do this, and they go, oh, okay. Yeah, okay, nah.
But you know what? Like, DigiDesign has an incredibly well-organized beta program where they're basically trying to hunt for bugs. I mean, there are plenty of brilliant people designing the feature set. Mm-hmm. And they do listen to users about feature requests too. But when it comes time to beta testing, it's about taking the design that's already been very carefully thought out and just making it not have bugs. And they're one of the best organized companies.
Yeah.
Now, when you beta test your software, do you just bizarre situations just to try to overload it? Like, let's take this plugin and feed it back through itself and you know what, 30 of them.
For me, that's just normal life. So, yeah, all the time. Exactly.
Lots of times you'd get an app and, you know, the new build, and you'd stick it in and start an all day's work, and it would just take a big dump on you. And you're like, what, guys, what, you know, whatever. And it's... Yeah, just you do push it. I don't typically try and, you know, patch something to something to try and crash it. I just try and use it. And
in everyday opportunities, yeah. I mean, you want to use the application like you always use it, mostly to the extremes of what you do. Right. But you want to just see, you know, start off, does it work? Okay, does it work under these conditions? Then you start loading up the sessions. How far can it go before it starts, you know, maxing out, putting external time code to different certain things, basically outside influences, how does it react, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, but if it doesn't just crash on its own in normal use, I still think it's fun to try to bring it down, just to try to destroy it.
Oh, yeah.
Rob the destroyer.
You know, it's nice to try and destroy it, but it's not. You don't go out. I tell you something, I don't know about you, but lots of times, certainly my beta, I have a beta hard drive, and I use that for beta testing when I'm not on like a time crunch, because these things do fall on their faces. Talking of which, I had like a day lost yesterday because of a beautiful Stein bug. You know, the inability for something, and it just took a dump, and there was a day gone. Yeah.
But usually when you beta test it, it'll be like, hey, it works, everyone's great. Hey, here's the new build. Oh, that doesn't work. And also the BBS, everyone's going, doesn't work, try this. Everyone tries it, hey, look, it works.
Okay. Well, there have been plenty of times where we thought we were using release software. You know, we paid for release software. We're not even signed up as beta testers, and sure enough, we're still finding bugs and reporting them back to the
manufacturer. Well, I love when you and I did the Orville. early on with Eventide.
Oh, for Eventide, yeah.
And we weren't sure because we were using special PC software. And there were so many different points that can go wrong that when things were happening, I remember all three of us were looking around the computer going, is it still working? Is it supposed to be doing this? And we just sat there and looked and go, okay, try this. I don't know if this is right. Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. You know,
yeah, things were pretty complicated then. It's a lot easier now with Eventide plugins.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They basically just work.
But that was alpha. I mean, that was like, here's a box.
Yeah.
You know.
Some of the software that you guys beta tested, have any of the titles gone to like a public beta? And do you notice a big difference between the public betas and like the closed beta?
Yeah, I think I don't usually get involved in the public beta.
Isn't public beta version 1?
Well, public beta just usually
version
means
7, depending on what company it is.
Public beta usually just means something they don't want to support, and right. They're not necessarily interested in hearing how you made it crash.
Although I will say, like Propellerhead, you know, with their reason, they do a good public beta version before
right.
They stamp it official. And so, and you know, it was beta tested before.
Of course, their stuff is unbelievably stable. They're probably the best.
They're really good, I will say.
Company for that.
I mean, the guys, if I've downloaded a couple beta releases of some of their software, and it runs really well as soon as you download it.
Well, if you look at their history of maintenance releases, they don't have many because they don't need to because their stuff just works.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. And also, I will say that, you know, as much as Bobby complains about Steinbug, he is an avid Nuendo. I mean, we've had some really good Nuendo Pro Tools arguments in our days.
They're all good. They're all good. I mean, I like the features, but they're all good. They're all good.
What I want to do is
wake Morgan.
Yeah, we're going to wake
Morgan.
I want to hear what Morgan has to say.
Yeah, what software do you beta test? Well, I've done a word
processor. Here's the question. Avid or Final Cut?
Final Cut.
Ah!
Yeah, I actually do have an Avid story that I cut my first documentary on the first Avids that came out. This was in 92, end of 92, and they were only cutting TV commercials at the time. And I was trying to cut a feature-length documentary. And, you know, memory was incredibly expensive at the time. And we couldn't afford the machines because they were incredibly expensive at the time. But I knew somebody that had one from 10 at night till 8 in the morning that I could use. So I didn't sleep for about a year. And we were cutting it, and it was so buggy. And the customer support, they only had that one phone number in Massachusetts where the Avid people were sitting. And they were horrible at their customer support to the point where the day Final Cut got stable enough where I could kiss Avid goodbye, I never look back, and
wow,
I never will.
Wow,
yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Brought to you by Apple.
Man, I hope my Pro Tools doesn't crash.
Their support has improved.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, back in the day,
no, it sucked.
Sure was bad.
Of course, you've done some really good stuff with your Final Cut, so I don't blame you for changing over. You've done some really good projects on that.
It's amazing, though, just talking to these bugs and everybody saying how it sets such a bad taste in people's mouths forever, more or less. Because, I mean, I don't know. I don't know anything about Avid, but I'm sure maybe they are a lot better now. But the companies really don't understand that when they start pissing people off on that level, it stays with you forever.
It really does. And was that in the pricing, you know, that they were just
No real competition. And
exactly. They acted like Monopoly, and they thought everybody had to come to them forever. And as soon as we didn't, we left, you know.
Yeah.
Which I mean, talking of Pro Tools and doing this, I mean, this is maybe a controversial point, but do you think the Pro Tools will be around in 5 years' time? And I say that, I don't mean Pro Tools will be around in 5 years' time. It most probably will be. But do you think?
I hope so. We're still going to be paying off the systems we're buying.
Yeah, really. Exactly.
Yeah, really.
But do you think it will still have as much of a market share as it has? Because, I mean, it's.
I will tell you that being as huge of a Pro Tools fan that I am,
right.
and I use it 8 hours a day, I find there's a lot of other audio applications out there that will serve me better in certain instances. You know,
because the market, the competition's picking up. Definitely.
Yeah, but you know what? It's interesting. I did I used to teach at UCLA. Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Extension class.
I did a comparative study of digital workstations, and at the time there were 52 of them when I did it. And we were talking about, you know, DAR and Lexicon and Korg had one. Everybody had one. And there are very few of them that are mainstream now, but I think there's a lot more, you know, obviously everyone's looking at Apple to see what their next logical step is. Nuendo's out there, but you know, Yamaha's bought them, and nobody's sure what's happening with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the future like? So everyone's waiting. I think there's a lot of huge Nuendo fans.
You're going to see Nuendo in a hardware box soon, I bet.
Well, I think the thing is, you know, it's for the people that are, especially in post-production, it's got to be ease and interface. And I think that if somebody comes out with something just as good as Pro Tools, it's not good enough. It's got to be something better. But a lot of problems that I find, even with Final Cut, you know, you're going to have to give me your OMF tracks. Well, can you do that? Can I put it into Pro Tools? Can I put it into Nuendo? Can it interface with other platforms? Then when the editorial gets it, we got to go to a dubbing stage. Okay, I don't own the dubbing stage. I'm going to go somewhere else. Can I take that format and bring it to another place? I think connectivity is hugely important. Then we want to lay back to a D5. Can we do it digitally? Can we not? What is the process? And that, I think, with all of the workstations, especially in post-production type purposes, is the most important thing. It's just got to run smoothly. Nobody's got the time.
Well, Scott, you made a really good point. And I think the reason why Pro Tools is the 900-pound gorilla is because of three letters, OMF.
Yeah.
I mean, it was OMF that brought the compatibility between the Avid and Pro Tools that allowed us to start mixing post-production so easily from the cuts that the offline editors
and are then doing. Pro Tools to MMRs, MMPs, basically dubbing playback machines.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it works well enough. And also a lot of things is a lot of the people in the business aren't as technical, and they learn a tool, they like that tool, and the tool serves them well. They just rather stay on it rather than having the feel to live on the cutting edge, bleed on it, find out they got the problems.
Right.
And clients, I mean, you know, when you do post-production, you don't want to be it's hard enough just creating a project, let alone worrying about the technicalities of the tools to finish the project. I just want my project done.
Well, if there's going to be a DAW that's going to come out and we'll be able to take the editor's output, whether it's an AAF or an OMF, and you're able to mix it and spit it out back to tape or probably even to a file, and they'll marry it in their own system somewhere, then I think there's room in the market for more DAWs. You know, Pro Tools won't be the 900-pound gorilla.
Well, the thing is,
but right now they do it, you know, they're the best at that.
What Pro Tools is to Avid, blah, blah, fill in the blank, is to Apple.
Right.
I mean, it's to Final Cut. And what's interesting is, you know, while Digi tends to be Digi and Avid tend to be a very closed system because you've got to go by their rules, Apple is a very open system. So if they start creating solutions to Final Cut, they're going to share that. And it's going to be $900.
But the big problem with Final Cut, that as a post-production mixer, is you cannot import your volumes. So the temp mix that
I just bought some program called Audio Duck.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Which I just spent $500 on a couple weeks ago. That did just that. Which you can export your levels from an editor's mix directly into a Pro Tools session.
Now, as soon as that yeah. happens in the program itself without Audio Duck, I think it would really going to be even more of a threat, because that's always been my biggest complaint, and actually my client's complaint too, is because they spend all this time on their temp mix to get it close to where they want it, and then I import it, and then it's all gone. I say, well, we got to start from the beginning. And they worked. Well, no, we did this, and the editor did that. It's not like I'm just sitting there and laying back. I make improvements on what the editor did, but at the same time, they pretty much know where they want to get to. They pretty much want to get to a certain point, and then as a mixer, you take it forward. Well, right now, aside from the duck, but right now, Pro Tools, that does it the best. You know, you import it, it'll convert all the automation on the regions to automation on Pro Tools, and it just saves a lot of time, and it really makes clients really happy.
Yeah, I still think it's interesting, living in the now generation, or the now a decade. What I find interesting is I'm seeing a lot of picture cutters having their own systems, whether it's in like an Avid Express or Final Cut, bringing laptops. Before it used to be a whole Avid system which was networked, and they're going to the director going, what do you think of this cut? Or better yet, they're just sending out QuickTimes or some form of AVI file, shipping it to them saying, what do you think of this cut? So I think that that's going to be very interesting. I think the days of having a hardware machine that does this thing, it's all changing.
I mean, I'll say that just from a production point of view, that it's having the versatility of I'm an Apple head. You know, I think I own nine, and
nine
Apples, And I use them for everything. You know, I have a graphics station, and I have a digging station. I have two edit bays, and I have all my other computers, and just the interchangeability, the fact we can do graphics. We're all hooked up through Ethernet, and the editor can be editing, and the other guy in the other room can be, you know, digging and loading those files on to the computer that's editing at the same time, and, you know, all that kind of interconnectability. And then I can take it to my laptop and, you know, work on it in the field. You know, and now we're shooting sometimes with, you know, we just shot something with a new small Panasonic HD with the memory card, and you load it directly on. You know, it's just so easy.
We're going to have to talk about that later because I want to know how that goes, because I got a DVX-100A and I love that camera.
So. I have two of them. I love them too.
Wow. But now with Mactel basically coming out, now it's kind of Intel computers.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden it's going to be, you know, there's really one computer out there these days.
That's true.
But it's still the OS. I mean, absolutely. I mean, boot camp, you're going to be able to boot up in Windows and and get all the viruses.
And then what is interesting to see, you know, what Vista is going to bring to the game.
Oh, smoking. I tell you something. Have you seen Vista, the pictures of it on the screenshots? They've complete. I don't know how they get away with it. They've completely ripped off the Mac interface. They've even got like the bubble kind of looking buttons, but it's in black, it looks like. And they've got the little widgets and everything. It's like, oh, hello. Yeah, whatever.
It is pretty hilarious now. Apple is running these commercials with one guy who's love a PC them. And one guy who's a Mac. But now the Macs are going Intel. It's
That's why I'm not on a Mac actually right now, because it's so PC-fied.
Well, I will say that the technology is getting – I'm excited by it just from the fact that I was in a mix the other day and they did not like the way it ended. So the editor pulls out his little PowerBook, has a little FireWire drive. He goes in there. He reworks the ending sound-wise. Sends me an OMF. I grab the OMF. I import it into the session. Boom, it's gone. I mean, all in the same time. He didn't have to go back. He didn't have to drive anywhere. He just did it. We just did it right then and there. And that was like, man, you know, technology is really, really, really gaining hold of just speeding up the process when you can do something like
that. But, you know, what's interesting is that even I saw on the new Pro Tools announced, I think, is that they're now going to be able to combine video clips in Pro Tools.
Right.
Which that means if you've got your director picture editor sitting behind you with their laptop going, oh, I came up with a different ending. How about this? Boom. You put the picture in. Oh, hey, okay, let's edit and mix. Great. You know, so they could be changing all the way into delivery.
Which is my – which
lovely.
I tell you, what's going to be the wave of the future is what I call a super bay, where you're going to be able to do picture and you're going to be able to do some audio all in the same bay. I mean, it's just on its way right now. In my studio, I can do Final Cut and I can do Pro Tools and I can change on a dime. And that's just the way it's going
to
go.
And then you go on the network, you send it to Color Correction, they do their thing, they send it out. It goes digital delivery to wherever it's going to go, because, you know, D5, make a file. Pop it to where it's got to go, send to New York. They broadcast it over DirecTV. There you go.
Well, that was a little turn. We were talking about NAB, and then we left turn.
Was anyone putting down breadcrumbs?
Well, I'm going to take us back into NAB really quick, but we can always go off on those tangents. It's not a big deal. Sony came out with a preview of a new software called CineScore, where essentially it will make the soundtrack for you. It has preset styles, and it makes the soundtrack for you. And you don't even have to do loops. You can just basically, you know, give it a style from what I was reading, and it'll generate the hit points and the things that you need it to do.
I'll also go home now, Rob.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're done.
That's awesome.
That's it.
But see, which gets me back to on our very first podcast, where we were talking about the technology making people lazy, making people, you know, is it helping or hurting people? And then you see something like this come out. Rob, as a composer, and you too, Bobby, I know these aren't threats to you, but do you think
they are? They're challenging.
Well, because
some of our clients, the less informed ones, might actually think that that's a viable option to having a real
composer.
Well,
that's true too.
You have more informed clients there.
You know, my point was, I was going to say, do you think this could actually be an asset to your to your composing, because you can get editors that can kind of say, hey, I want it to sound sort of like this, and they've already kind of generated something.
Actually, I think Bobby and I could just go to work for CineScore.
Right? Actually, scary thing is, I think I have got some tracks on
Are you serious?
Yeah. I did some stuff for a guy, for Jeff Rohner, actually, for Liquid Cinema. He has a sound library set, and I did a bunch of...
You've destroyed the industry, Bobby.
Yeah, right, I did.
So some of your preset loops are in there.
No, not loops, but I did like a bunch of sound design for it. I think it is. All the theatrical crap.
Wow, that's kind of...
So aren't you going to feel funny as soon as you lose a gig to it?
I know.
Well, at least you got paid.
You lose a gig to yourself.
Yeah.
Hey, can you do it
and
exactly?
And the Oscar for composition goes to...
No, I just saw that, and
you know, to answer your question, you said, do you think it's going to make people lazy, and would Rob and I or whoever's composing, I would definitely buy something like that. I have tons of, obviously, we have loop libraries now, and I use them, sure. If somebody says, you know, have you got something like this, and it's a low-budget demo sort of thing, or you're a mini mock land, you're not going to sit there and bust your balls just to try and come up with something great. You got, you know, just to get to find out seven ideas, you put, you know, use a bunch of loops, stick them together and get in something quick so they can actually decide.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Not as a final, but hey, you know, if the loops are cool and groovy and it's got a character, why not?
Yeah, I think demo, it's going to be a good way to demo things.
Oh, but you also realize that Ludwig by Hybrid Arts used to be that program on the Atari.
I beta tested for them.
Yeah,
too.
You remember? And then
Simtitrack.
You guys are old.
I know, we'd be old.
And then part of
what's an Atari?
And most people don't realize, but DirectX had that feature in it, where you would put a melody, and when it would come up with the, you know, MIDI score, it can come up with its own melody, and it would just, you know, do that. But everyone went, yeah, okay, whatever.
Well, yeah, the buzz on this is, and I was reading on a website. Oh, I forgot the name, and I want to give them credit, but anyhow, that the presets, there weren't enough presets, you know, so it's going to be like the basic 20 styles or something like that. So I don't know. Yeah, well, you won't get, you know, the polkas. You won't get the, you know, different kind of polkas. But Morgan, as a producer, director, writer, editor, all of the above, would you ever use something like that to kind of demo? How do you demo out your music for your...
I'm in a little bit of a different boat because I mainly make music documentaries, so the documentary's about the music.
Oh, that's true, too.
So,
lucky bastard.
Yeah, and the only handful of times I've done non-music documentaries, I've actually scored them myself.
That's right. I do remember that.
So I have myself to blame.
By the way, I have I've set up a niche market for myself. I don't know why this happened, but I ended up being called in on a bunch of music documentaries. There was, I think, actually a Nat King Cole one and a Rosemary Clooney one and a few others of singers who had died. And I became the guy who had to play sad piano versions of their biggest hits. And it got, yeah.
Sad piano
versions. So I know how to play, you know, a really morose version of Come On To My House.
Can you do Suck My Love Pump? D minor. The saddest of all keys.
Absolutely.
Oh, God. Spinal Tap.
Yeah,
quick,
love it.
A quick sidetrack there.
That's pretty funny. Well, hey, let's move on. One thing I wanted to...
All we've been doing is moving on. Let's try to stick to a topic.
Martin Page, yeah. You notice he's not here tonight.
That's right.
Yeah, he's obviously the rudder.
Martin, help us. He's drunk in an alley. Come on, let's be honest. No, I'm just kidding. One thing I wanted to do is I kind of wanted to do a plug for API and the fact that their ATD has come out. And I don't know if you guys know about the ATD, but that's the new API, analog to digital interface, where you've got the 512 front end two channels going into a really high end converter. And it's just really an amazing little box. You know, I'm going to bring one in here so you can check it out. But
and Larry Dropper wasn't allowed to talk about that last time he was here,
That's right. That was the product that he could not plug. And, boy, I wanted to try to get him to talk about it, but he just would not talk about it. So, Larry, you are a man of your word and not spilling the beans.
What's the outputs? Well, we won't go into technical outputs of the bloody thing. What's it got, though, on the outputs?
Well, it has SPDIF and AES outputs, and it also has... inserts in it. It's a
analog
great,
inserts.
Yeah, it's a great box. I mean,
96K top or 192?
Yeah, no, it goes 192. It's
and internal, external work clock only. Internal only. You
it has an no. It'll take an external work clock. And as a matter of fact, you can gang them together. I mean, if you want the ultimate front end of Pro Tools or any of your digital audio workstations, you can get 512Cs across and they'll ribbon cable together, and the top box will send clocks to all the boxes below it, and it's pretty amazing.
512Cs, is that what it's called?
No, it's called the A to D, but but the 512 is the API.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah.
Is the API mic pre, but it's great. It's their first digital product, and it's just a great product. So you guys are going to have to check that out. And you can check it out at apiaudio.com.
I prefer a D to A, actually, to tell the truth. I really want a good DTA. You said we're going to talk about that, but anyway, carry on.
Well, you know, you gotta have something to bring the sound in before you send the sound out.
Not necessarily. I've got this Sony Loop CD. Have you heard it?
That's true.
It's killer.
Hey, I still like the old days when everything was A to A.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well,
we're making.
That's right. We gotta let's.
Yeah, nice job staying on topic. Right,
there we go again. One thing I want to tell you guys out there is we're going to be doing a series of shows, seminars on different topics, and we're going to be doing one with Rob and the guys here on software. So we're going to get more into software. We're going to cover software plugins and software samplers, and we're going to be giving tips and hints. And so I just want to let you know that. And also that the Audio Nowcast, every 2 weeks we post a new show. I've gotten a couple of questions and when the podcasts are posted. We record on a Friday evening. That's why everybody's so happy. And we usually post by Sunday evening. Please know that the website's a work in progress, but we'll be getting it all up and running with the RSS feeds and actually the iTunes feeds too. So that's about it. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more with Morgan and about some of these documentaries.
Question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and right now we're going to be talking with Morgan Neville. Morgan, you've done just a ton of music documentaries. Everybody from Brian Wilson, Sam Phillips, Hank Williams, Muddy Waters. My first question is why? Why so much on music?
Well, I love music. Always have. I played in bands forever and realized at some point I was never going to make a living at it, as probably most of you did. This made the same realization. And,
you know what? Actually, they all make a living.
Oh, they do. That's right. You're professional composers. Right?
Unless you've heard something to the contrary.
I have. There's a CD coming out.
I, on the other hand, I made the same decision you did. That's why I mix.
And I was a journalist and, loved writing about music and decided why not make documentaries about it. Plus, I got to then travel and meet some of my favorite people and tell stories, and it's taken me interesting, strange places. And one of which I was starting to talk about earlier is that Sam Phillips, who ran Sun Records in Memphis.
That was a great documentary. One of my favorites to work on.
And meeting Sam, I went down to Memphis and spent a couple months with him. And this is about a year and a half before he died. And it was a life-changing experience. I mean, as soon as I came back from that, I actually quit my job. That's when I started working for myself. And because Sam was so completely inspirational, and what he did was open up a studio before it was Sun Records, was Memphis Recording Service. We record anything, anywhere, anytime, his business card said. And he did everything, weddings, memorial services, and, but his real passion was recording blues artists. And in Memphis, in 1950, when he opened his studio, that was really something you didn't do, especially for a white guy, And, he was so persecuted for doing it, he had a nervous breakdown and was actually sent into an institution and, went through electroshock therapy and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Wow.
I mean, this is in the service of the blues. How cool is that?
Wow.
And, and then he finally got Sun going in 53, found Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Rufus Thomas, and then in 55, of course, Elvis walked in the door.
I want to make a record for my mom.
Exactly. For his mom, that was his excuse to go into Sun. But, Sam was kind of his whole rap was that he loved sound. You know, there was always something he loved. And he came from Florence, Alabama, which is the same hometown as Helen Keller and who is it? The other blues great. But his whole thing is that, you know, he would hear the radio growing up as a kid, mm-hmm. and he knew he always wanted to be connected with it and share it. And to the end of his life, he owned a string of radio stations. And he would go out and drive around in his car trying to see where the best radio reception was. And he'd go back to the station and tune in the towers and, you know, tell them exactly how the frequency should be. You know, it was completely his obsession.
Wow. Is the studio still, is the structure still there?
Oh, the structure's still there. And now you can, you know, take a tour and everything. And, you can still record there. You know, I think they give tours till 6 p.m. And then if you want to rent it after 6 p.m., you can go in there and cut a record.
Smoking.
You know?
That's cool, yeah.
Do they have Pro Tools?
Not quite.
Thank God.
They had a nice old quarter-inch machine, I think, when we were in there. And they do have some more modern equipment, but... U2 recorded in there.
Right.
You can see them recording there and Rattle and Hum.
Yeah, Rattle and Hum.
It's just a simple room, you know, but that's, you know, Sam's whole thing was coming up with the slapback, you know, echo, the reverb, the slap echo that he did with two machines. That was kind of the trademark Sun sound. But it was all live recording, you know, and that's what they were doing. I mean, essentially it was glorified field recording, which is, you know, capturing an event as opposed to constructing a song, you know, out of various takes, you know, because Sam wasn't a producer in that way. He was more of like a, you know, musical anthropologist or something.
Wow. You know, you see in some of these movies that where Sam Phillips is portrayed as, you know, Mr. Phillips, you know, I want to record. And they come over and go into the studio and he sits there and he just, okay, roll. And then they get that one shot and they're either going to make it or they're not going to make it.
I mean, it's actually the thing I loved about the Johnny Cash movie, Walk the Line, is that scene.
Right. That's the scene I'm talking about.
You know, where, I mean, that's Sam as producer. You know, that's what producing was for Sam. It wasn't, you know, getting the mics right, though he certainly knew audio. It was about putting the fear of God into you, that you were going to do the best song the best way you could, or else you weren't going to be on record, you know? And that's what he did. You know, there's this incredible conversation with him and Jerry Lee Lewis that we used in the documentary, where Jerry Lee comes in drunk for a session and is convinced that he's singing the devil's music, and, you know, and he was always torn between going to the church or going into rock and roll. And he says, you know, I can't do this. And, you know, I'm going to go to hell if I sing this. And Sam, you know, completely convinces him that, you know, it's God's work to go and sing this music. And by the end of it, you know, and then, you know, that day they cut Great Balls of Fire, you know. So.
What, you know.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah.
It's, you know, watching Morgan's documentaries is I just have such a great appreciation for the way music was made back there, because it's so foreign to the way, you know, I make music or we make music, you know, today. And one documentary, the Hank Williams, that to me really, I was really amazed at Hank and how young he was when he died.
Yeah, 29.
He was only 29. You know, you think Hank Williams, at least I did before the documentary, and you're thinking, you know, this guy who had all this influence, you know, he was around for years, but he died at 29, and he just wore himself out, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he did, you know, all the cards are stacked against him, you know, so, you know, he was born with spinal bifida, he was an alcoholic, he was addicted to pills, he had a really difficult relationship with his first wife, and... you know, pretty much everybody wanted a piece of him. And then on top of that, he was spending every week driving, you know, 2 to 3,000 miles a week, if you can imagine, on roads before highways, so he could make it back to Memphis or to Nashville for Saturday night for the Grand Ole Opry broadcast, and then head out Sunday morning so he could hit all the, you know, his gigs for the week.
I also liked, you know, the story of Rufus Payne. I mean, not too many people, you know, I never knew who he was. And really, he had probably the most influence on Hank than anybody else.
I mean, this was a black street musician down in Alabama, in Georgiana, where Hank grew up, who was, you know, Hank befriended, you know, as a teenager. And, I mean, it's actually interesting. Sam, same thing, you know, had an influential blind, you know, African-American down in Florence, Alabama. that befriended him when he was a kid, you know, and to you know, understand just how singularly different that is difficult, you know. But I mean, even today, it's hard to imagine in Alabama those kinds of friendships in that kind of a way.
Yeah, because
and I've spent a lot of time in Alabama. But
what were the dates about that? Like in the '40s? That was in the '40s with Hank.
Yeah, with Hank. Yeah, forties.
Yeah,
I mean, during the war, and Sam about the same. Actually, they're probably about this exactly the same age.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing, especially that they could have those kind of friendships when, you know, it was so divided back then.
Yeah, exactly. It was completely frowned upon, but it never gave, you know, either of them any pause, you know, and that's part of what made Hank so great was, you know, he wasn't just singing, you know, country and western. He was singing My Bucket's Got a Hole in It and all these blues songs he knew, and that's what, you know, that was the sex he put into country music that made it honky-tonk.
I mean, you look at the blues and you know, with your documentary on Muddy Waters and how influential the blues is on just a lot of different musical styles, you know, rock and roll. And yeah, it all comes from the blues. Do you guys, Rob or Bobby, when you guys are composing, do you ever go to your like little blues riffs if you ever want to, you know, start taking something someplace different, you know, go to any kind of toolkit like that or?
Well, that tool, I mean, the blues toolkits, I mean.
Yeah, that's not someplace different. That's the root of everything.
You can't avoid it. I mean, but to go to the production, I mean, I think maybe it would mean like to do a production style. Not really, no. I wouldn't do it.
Right.
I wouldn't really do that. But yeah, you can. I mean, blues is fundamental core of music, really.
Like, let's get a little specific. When you say blues, fundamental core of music, the backbone of everything, what exactly are you talking about? Are you talking about the chord progressions themselves?
Sure. And I mean, 1-4-5 is the typical, I mean, let's just say, you know, that progression is used for everything. I mean,
what's a 1-4-5?
Well, please. He's a piano player.
Is this going to become a harmony?
I just want to break it down just for people.
Well, if you consider the root note in a key, if you're in C,
being one.
C would be one because that's a root note, and then 4 and 5 would be F and G.
Be dominant, subdominant.
Whoa, yeah. Very good.
I went to Berkeley, by the way.
You know, this podcast may be all over the place, but damn it, we're going to learn something.
Oh, this podcast is all over the place. You know what? I'm going to come back to something you said earlier because you said it just in passing that something to the effect of they don't make records like that anymore, you know, going back to Sam Phillips and that kind of thing. And the truth is, there's nothing about today's technology that stops you from making records the way they used to. I mean, we have much more high-tech ways of recording it, and you're not going to have as much hiss, and things are going to sound clean, and I guess there are more options for how to screw it up these days, you know, with the computers and everything. But the truth is, the process back then was brilliant, and there's nothing wrong with still working the same exact way. I mean, like with Sam Phillips, he expected you to be ready and, you know, just come out with an amazing performance because it wasn't so easy to do a billion takes and fix it later. So there's nothing wrong with being that prepared now.
I think you put it very well, actually. You said that there's people that actually would capture a performance like yes. That producer, or there'd be somebody that actually sits there and puts it together from either overdubbing and actually constructing something and faux finishing a performance.
And it's very easy and very you know, today when you're recording to kind of to hear the mistakes and say, oh, I'll fix that later or I'll patch this in or whatever. But, you know, back then you couldn't. And back then, you know, you just had to make the decision, does this have the thing, the X factor, the feel that makes it great? I mean, a story I always loved was, you know, when Percy Sledge cut the demo for Man Loves a Woman, you know, they recorded the demo and the keyboard's totally out of tune and they sent it up to New York and Jerry Wexler, you know, said, sounds great, but you know, great song, let's go back and record it and we'll get everything in tune. And they recorded it over and over and they could never get it right. And the version they put out was the demo. And if you listen to it, the keyboard's totally out of tune. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter.
But it doesn't matter, you know, because it has that thing.
I remember when I was a mixer, I used to mix people's records and they used to say, we really love this rough mix, we really love it. I'm like, well, release it then. I ain't going to sit and try and match it because you know, it's like you stick the faders all up at like 4 o'clock in the morning after just doing 19 overdubs of guitars and it's like, it sounds great. It's the best spirit, you know, it's an amazing thing. I think Quincy Jones said, I don't want to misquote him, he said, but you basically press record and hopefully something magic happens or God walks through the room, I think it was his words, but either way. which is true. You can't.
I mean, the other thing that that Sam did that was really revolutionary is he didn't have any clocks in the studio. And I mean, contrast that with what was happening in New York around the Brill Building, which was the Tin Pan Alley scene, which was union sessions, 4 hours, three songs a session, period, every session. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what Sam did is, you know, if you recorded for 24 straight hours, if that's what it took, and if you didn't even get anything, fine. But, you know, that was his understanding.
He was an artist. It was definitely...
And then, you know, that's what, you know, the Chesses then emulated. Sam was cutting for Chess Records. I mean, he cut those Wolf tracks and Jackie Brenston and the Ike Turner stuff that Chess was releasing, and the Chess opened their own studio. But, you know, they were doing the same thing, basically. And all those kind of, you know, small labels that had their own studios emulated that, you know, which is what made those so great.
I remember having a studio. The first thing I did, well, first thing I heard anyway when I was a kid growing up, take the clocks out of the studio, take the clocks. You don't want, you know, also you don't want to curb the people's inspiration, but you want them to go as long as possible because you're charging them by the hour.
But, you know, but Morgan said that one of the things that was so unique about Sam Phillips, he'd take the, he had no clocks in the studio, and I immediately was thinking he didn't have an hard sink or a big bag. Shows how twisted that is. I hate to say it, but that's really the first thing that came across my mind.
Is that what you thought? Wow. Rob, take that little button and go back decades.
Sorry.
You know, let's talk about the Brill Building and you know, expanding on what Rob was saying about how there really isn't any reason why you can't write songs like that, like they used to back then. You look at the Brill Building, and that was amazing the way they had that whole factory set up. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the Brill Building for people who don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the Brill Building was kind of the last vestige of Tin Pan Alley. You know, Tin Pan Alley originally had been on 20th Street in Manhattan, and then it moved up to Times Square, Upper Times Square. And the Brill Building was kind of the center of that scene. And it wasn't just this one building that still stands at 49th and Broadway, but it was a group of buildings around there. And they had cubicles with songwriters who would sit there all day banging out songs. And in the basements, most of those buildings were demo studios where they would record. And then, you know, surrounded by that were the record companies and their big major studios. And, you know, there were a lot of famous songwriters, you know, more Broadway songwriters that were associated. But, you know, my documentary is concentrating on the young teenagers that were brought in to write pop songs, you know, because these old songwriters didn't know how to write songs for kids. They'd write things like "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?" and think that was a song teenagers would want to listen to.
Right, because it was right at the time where it was, you know, rock and roll was just kind of breaking out and pop music was just kind of fighting against
the record companies couldn't get a handle on how to, you know, and certainly the songwriting business couldn't get a handle on how do you write Elvis songs. You know, Lieber and Stoller could do it, but they didn't come out of that system. And Don Kirshner, who was a music publisher in New York, hired literally teenagers, you know, Carole King when she was 17 years old. If you can imagine that, she wasn't out of high school and she had a job writing songs in New York with Jerry Goffin, her partner, and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, Jeff Berry, Nellie Greenwich, Neil Sedaka, who was the first person to have a hit out of that scene, who was an old boyfriend of Carole King's from Brooklyn. And, you know, Howie Greenwich, Doc Pomus, Mort Shuman, you know, on and on.
What were some of the songs that came out of that?
Everybody doing
the Locomotion. Yeah.
I actually mixed the Carole King, actually, is my wife's quite a good friend, and I mixed her album, which was a live album called Tapestry Live. Sorry. Yeah. It was the live record, and she's a lovely person. And I remember when I was mixing a record, and the first time I met her, I was asking all these questions. She was saying, "You're a strange engineer. Why are you asking me these questions?" I was like, "Why?" And I was asking her the chords, because she had all the cool songs, you know. And she was saying that's exactly right. They were machines, though. They were writing, writing machines. I mean, great songs too.
It's the opposite of the kind of, you know, just letting inspiration speak to you. It was, you know, Kirshner would bring in an artist, you know, Bobby V or the Drifters, and say, "Okay, we need a hit for them to follow up this last record. All of you go write the next hit, and whichever's best gets the record." And so they'd all go in the next room for 6 hours, and whoever
listen
came out, with, you know, exactly, through the vents,
yep.
You know, and you never whistled in the elevator, and, yep, you know, you're very careful.
You never whistled. Yeah. They used to rip each other off. Yeah. They used to big time.
And, you know, but you know, a lot of the great Drifter songs on Broadway, Up on the Roof, you know, Uptown.
Lieber and Stoller,
Lieber and Stoller stuff, too, all the Coaster stuff. You know, plus, you know, Burt Bacharach was there,
goosebumps.
Too.
I always get goosebumps when I talk about real
deals.
All
the Dionne Warwick stuff, you know, it's incredible what came out of there.
Yeah, just amazing.
You know, but it was such a different system, and it eventually broke down just in the mid '60s because, you know, the Beatles and Dylan and everybody said, well, if you're a serious artist, you write your own songs.
Right.
And so a lot of these artists, interestingly enough, either went to Nashville, went into commercial writing, or went into bubblegum writing. You know, Jeff Berry wrote Sugar Sugar, you know, went on to have a lot of other bubblegum songs.
What was Carol King's? She did, what was it, the Donny Osmond song? It was a silly little song.
Puppy Love?
Puppy Love, exactly.
Wow. I didn't even know she wrote that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, that's amazing.
They went, yeah.
You know, you talk about that, and you just
talent. Those people were just wicked.
But that's songwriting on a level that a lot of people nowadays just can't comprehend, because you don't have a loop to start with. You don't have a preset to start with. Yeah, you start with just the melody and the a foundation of music.
Down to 1/4, 1/5. No, that was all. It was all down to yeah, exactly. People, they were players. They're all average players. Not all of them were great players, but they all could play, at least play, chop out a couple of chords and come up with nice melodies. And it was a creative time.
I was just going to say, and you know, the people that really took that music and elevated it were the producers too.
Sure.
I mean, look at what Bacharach did and what Lieber and Stoller did with, you know, the Dionne Warwick stuff and the Drifters stuff, you know, and adding strings to R&B music and all that. I mean, they were visionaries in their own way too, you know, what they could do in the studio.
I actually have a theory. Well, it wasn't exactly a theory, but I just thought really that round about...
Wait, you had a thought?
I know, and I really do. But I was listening to I Am album, which is kind of slightly off the curve, but it's Earth, Wind & Fire record, I don't know if you remember, for about 28 years ago. So, I mean, but it's absolutely smoking. The playing on it, the writing's beautiful. And the recording quality is smoking too, production and everything. And I really think that was kind of like a perfect storm, not that record necessarily, but that era was kind of like the perfect storm for the music industry, because there was still... The fundamental was still writing. Technology was used. There was harmonizers and starting, you know, digital tricks, but not much. But there was still writing was the core of it, and production was, and the music technology was really at the peak. It was a peak of analog recording, really. And I really think that was about the peak for the music industry, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's like it was all firing on all its cylinders right then.
It really was.
There.
I mean, from the 50s right through, it kind of peaked there because technology married it. All the songs were great. They weren't all cheesy. It wasn't that... And then, of course, you know, then they started commoditizing it, and off we go.
Yeah,
and here we go.
I've spent a lot of time in Nashville recently doing a bunch of documentaries, and I just did one about the history of women in country music, and it's become a major issue, the kind of the tuning of voices and, you know, all the kind of manipulation that goes on.
Auto-tune.
Auto-tune, yeah. That I mean, that's a hot topic amongst artists, you know, and...
Are they pro or con? Yeah.
Well, it depends how good your voice is.
Right. You know? They're con till they need it. That's what I find.
Of all the documentaries that you've done, has there been one where you found something that you didn't expect on one of the artists, you know, on any artist? Is there anything that you went in with maybe a preconceived idea and all of a sudden, you know, somebody surprised you, or any surprises that were just like little
Barry
gems?
Came in about
the person. Yeah. Or about...
There are always surprises. You know, where to start? You know, I mean, somebody I haven't talked about is you know, Brian Wilson, that I spent a long time making a documentary about. And I mean, he's such a complex character. But also, I mean, as great of a songwriter as he is, he's a great producer, which people don't think about. But, you know, what he was doing at those studios, Western.
Well, that's true. He was the inspiration for Sgt. Pepper, right? Pet Sounds came out before.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Paul McCartney says. You know, but certainly what he was doing with the same session musicians, the Wrecking Crew that everybody else was using at the time, and, you know, emulating a lot of what Phil Spector was doing, but then kind of, I think, taking it to the next level. You know, and again, you know, throwing away the clock. You know, most of these are union guys, and Brian had enough power that they could, you know, run union guys for 15 or 16 hours at a time and pay them quadruple overtime. You know, but if it's, you know, if it's what Brian wanted, he got it, and the music, you know, paid dividends. You know, he was. So in terms of, I mean, there were so many surprises about Brian. You know, he was kind of endlessly fascinating, because he's seemingly so, you know, simple. But as somebody said to me, you know, you would never think that
people just could never get their mind wrapped around the fact that Mozart was living in Hawthorne. You know, that, you know, here's somebody with this incredibly innate, natural power who can't even express in intellectual terms. It's a completely natural force. You know, who's a kid who's into cars hanging out the Foster's Freeze in Hawthorne, you know, and reconciling those two worlds is what Brian had to deal with, you know, with his family, his cousins, and everything else. So,
as a person who's made all these documentaries, why don't you tell us some of your reflections, and I know you're a musician too, about, you know, some of the studios that are closing and how things are changing and just music itself. And I'm also going to ask you guys too a follow-up question on this, because, you know, you look at places like the Hit Factory, you know, closes its doors. I mean, we're losing a lot of our – I mean, think of all the great studios just in Los Angeles that are closing. We're losing a lot of our heritage.
Yeah, Gold Star closed, you know, many years ago, 10 years ago now, and that's where Phil Spector did his recordings. And then Western was the place on Sunset where, you know, Pet Sounds was recorded. And, I mean, all the great albums recorded there. It's incredible. And, I mean, at least the building's still standing. You know, Gold Star's now a mini mall. But, but, you know, and home recording is great, and we love it. But it doesn't mean we should, you know, tear down these right. monuments. I mean, the one studio that I adore that's left is the Capitol Studio. I mean, Studio A, B, and C, but, you know, A in particular is just a magic room.
But did you know, did you read in the newspaper that they want to take the top part of the Capitol Tower and turn it into condos?
I did.
Yes.
That's a good idea. Get rid of the record company and keep the studio. Get rid of that at the top.
But that's just it. I mean, it starts at the top and it's going to move its way down because then they're going to need parking. And there goes the studios. And
in Studio B, people will be like doing their laundry or something. The condos upstairs.
I mean, that is such a – really, when I read that, I just couldn't believe it because that's such a – it's such an icon, especially when you go into – Capitol, when you go down the hallway and you see all these pictures,
oh, the pictures. That's
of
amazing.
Like Frank Sinatra, Nat King
Cole,
and,
yeah,
and you're walking into that same room. It's just, it really is. It just, it's enough to just give you chills. You know, you look at the closing of all these studios, and I want to ask you guys, what do you think music is going to lack, or what will you miss with studios closing like that? How do you think it's going to affect modern music, or do you think it's going to have any effect on modern music? Is there, because you've all worked in studios that are probably no longer there, is there something you'll miss about the fact?
I think it's already
gone. I think it's already happened.
Yeah. And we haven't, you know, the recording studios, I have a question to put to you guys after this, but I think recording studios have closed their doors, you know, not necessarily literally, but they've been out the you know, park for the last 8-10 years, really. I mean, nobody really goes out and cuts live anymore in a studio. Why? You know, it's more fun, supposedly, and also sometimes it is creatively more fun to rent a house in Hollywood and go and slam your drums and cut them in the kitchen or something. You know, it's fun. Why not? If the technology is there, that's a great idea.
You think?
So I think that the effect is that it's gone,
and it's not going to come back. Well, that's true too. But I don't know. I you watch some of these documentaries, and you watch like a Sam Phillips, you know, here you are, you're a young band, you want to go start out. At least if you went to Sam right then and there, you could get like this totally unbiased just critique right off the bat and know whether you had it or you didn't.
That's original magic.
And go into the performance as opposed to nowadays where you can kind of – you don't know if you have it and you can kind of dink around and you may never get it.
Well, but if you work with a really good producer or you are a really good producer, that's the same thing. I mean the room you're in and the tools you're using, and I'm sure Martin would be saying this if he was here, you know, the melody is much more important than any of those things.
Yeah, so I think the melody.
But you know, one thing I think that when you go back to Sun recordings and all that is that I think that we had grown in the music business to a point where it did become so much of a machine that you were either part of the club or you weren't, and most of the doors were always closed to you. So I think you couldn't afford the gear, you couldn't get the studio time. If you were somewhat talented, it was all about luck of being able just to be part of that world, to get into the Capitol, to get into the studios. And I think that there was a tremendous amount of talented people for whatever reasons. Their path didn't go that way. I know we had on other pod discussions that, you know, it's easy to make mediocre music. But at the same point, what I think is fascinating, I think we're actually heading full circle back to those early days, because what's happening, I think, is people are able to experiment. People that are really the cream of the crop, the next generation of just amazing people, instead of it being dictated to them, they could sit in their living room and just experiment and try and record things and really use the tools that are available and to really come up with amazing stuff, and then be able to present it in a medium that is much more open-ended than it's ever been.
You know, Scott, that's a great point. And the fact that, you know, the internet is almost in a way the new Grand Ole Opry.
It's
the big distribution. Instead of happening at Saturday night, what time was the Grand Ole Opry Saturday?
Well, they had two shows a night, early show that wasn't broadcast and a later show. It's like 6 and 8, I think, are the two shows.
See, I knew. If anybody knew that answer, I knew Morgan did. But the internet, it's, you know, you can get your you were saying something really good about comparing the internet, that it was it crossed all borders.
What so many people talk about the Grand Ole Opry, Ray Charles talks about this, and, you know, even Muddy Waters, all these guys, blues guys, say they all were familiar with country music because of listening to the radio, you know, and it was WSM out of Nashville was a 50,000-watt station that cleared, you know, you could hear it in New York on a clear night. You know, so that's when, you know, when Ray Charles cuts Modern Sounds and Country and Western, it's because he grew up listening to that stuff in the Florida Panhandle on Saturday nights, you know, because he could get the radio station. And the internet in the same way, you know, doesn't have any boundaries. You know, you can get anything you want anywhere you want now. You know, and if you're a teenager in Florida or Alaska or Bangladesh, you know, and you have access to the internet, that you can get whatever you want.
But did you feel that there was a commonality with all the artists, even if they were working in the sweatshops of music? All of the young people seemed to be incredibly passionate. People were just, you know, insane. This is the only thing they think they could do. This was their life, even though it made no sense to everybody else in the world. Why would you be doing this? It's a path that they had to follow. Did you find that everybody almost had the nothing to lose? I have to do this deed. I have to follow this path. Was there commonalities that you found within amongst all these people, passions? Or?
Yeah, I think for the most part, people that have succeeded in that way were either incredibly driven or, you know, just incredibly blessed in a way that they almost had to succeed. You know, there are stories of people who kind of right place, right time, you know, who've succeeded and had long careers. You know, Gene Autry was probably one of them. You know, nice guy, good singer, good businessman, but really kind of right place, right time. But, you know, yeah. I think for the most part, people that have those kind of mega careers as producer, songwriter, singer, obviously have something, you know, that's driven them. And, you know, I think what's interesting about, you know, I think about the days of there being hundreds of small record labels, and, you know, anybody could put out any record, and there, you know, there was regionality in America too. You know, there was regional radio, and there were local labels in your hometown at local radio stations that played local music. I mean, that doesn't exist anymore, and that's kind of what the internet's finally bringing back. I mean, it's not local, but it's, you know, it's local in a,
well, it's community,
in a global way. It's communities, based. You know, so it's not, you know.
Let me ask you this, because as an artist yourself, I mean, not only as a musician, but as a filmmaker, because I see the same, we were talking about this before, I see the same trend happening, that before great songs were made, because the people weren't available to technology, so they had to really look at what the root of music was and do the best they can with the little they had. And then obviously music's progressed into high production. Now you look at filmmakers that, you know, it'd be great to be able to create a Jurassic Park, but the reality is the budgets aren't there and the people that you would need to create that. So now as a young filmmaker and you know, trying to show your wares and your talents as an artist, creating your product, and now the whole indie film industry is huge, where people can show their stuff. How do you view the internet and your art form?
I mean, the internet's just part of a whole wave of technology that's made filmmaking so much more democratic. And, you know, especially in documentary, I say, you know, thank God it's about time, you know, that, I mean, things like Final Cut and good, you know, cheaper cameras, both HD and standard def, on the one hand, have, you know, made, I look at the boom going on in documentary right now, and that's directly related to the technology.
Do you see that as cable technology, or is that more towards internet?
Well, I'm talking about production technology, oh, right, but then, I mean, what's going to be interesting is to see, as everybody is trying to figure out these days, how to make money off of it, you know. Yeah, you can download things, but, you know, is it going to sustain itself, you know, and, you know, we don't know.
See, so, I may be sounding old school. That seems to be my job here from week to week.
Mind you thought of Big Ben when you were talking about Sun Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So sometimes I'm new school, sometimes I'm old school. There's nothing wrong with the fact – I mean, I love that the technology makes it easy for anybody to try any idea. But there is still a level that you rise to when a songwriter has real talent or a producer has real talent or a filmmaker has real talent. The big studios and the big companies are going to be interested in their product because, you know, it is commercially viable. And there are still different levels that people operate at. And getting back to the point about talking about studios and how many studios are going under, I mean, there's, as far as I can tell, there's always going to be a reason that a 40-piece string section on a song sounds better than a sampled string section on a song. And to record that 40-piece string section, you have to go into a studio. You can't do that at home.
Here's the thing. Sorry.
No, and I'm just saying, so those kinds of studios, even if there's only one in each town, those studios are still going to have to exist, and it's still going to be something to aspire to as a songwriter, that you want to be able to make records that sound that good. Or CDs or chips or whatever it is at that point.
Bobby,
I was gonna actually, I forgot to ask this question when I started talking about 3 years ago. But let's say somebody waved a magic wand and they said all the studios in town are like $200 a day now. Any studio you like, you can go over there and get a great engineer, great gear, Pro Tools, analog, SSL, whatever you want. Would you guys go out and record in them? I would.
But also, you're thinking studios. What about churches? What about town halls? What about
no?
But
there's an amazing vibe
in a studio when
right.
you walk
there's,
in.
There's something you go in, you smell the smoke from the last night, and yeah, new donuts and the.
I absolutely would, by the way, in answer to your question. 100%.
And before, may I just finish, because it's sort of kind of related to what Rob was saying about, does a 40-piece string section sound better than a Giga studio? So needless to say, it does. But to integrate the internet kind of distribution or conglomeration or whatever connection theory. There's a place in England, and I'm sure there's others, and I can't remember the bloody name of the place, but it's a guy that's a conductor and a first violinist, and he's got I think 28 people, and you email him your score, yeah, and you email him your style, and he does the strings for you, sends you the MP3, see if you dig it or whatever, and then that's it. Great. He'll digitally deliver it to you. Mm-hmm. And he has a great studio, and he's got a great space. So I foresee that possibly, and I know drummers have done that for a long time.
Yeah. Is he from Germany? Isn't the guy from Germany?
Actually, I think he's in England.
Oh, is he?
I think so. But either way, I mean, yeah. I'm sure that will happen. There's orchestras, of course, overseas that you can go to, not to take away from local, but you can, of course. But it's just going to be a matter of time until, you know, if somebody calls you up and says, hey, Rob, will you mind playing piano for me? Do me some sad, really sad piano.
Yeah.
Right. Give me some shared piano. I'm in Russia right now.
Yeah.
You would do great. It's a great way of doing it. But it still doesn't – it's not as greasy as getting in there and saying, hey, Rob, how's it going? Hey, Mike, how are you guys doing? You know, talk about the crap and have lunch and also feel nervous about the actual performance of your part of the job that day. That's what makes
– You know what, though? I also think it's still healthy, even though every kid in the world can have a studio on his laptop computer.
Uh-huh.
I still think it's healthy that they can write a song that they then aspire – to getting some money people excited about so they can go in and put a real orchestra on it. Right. And that's still there. I mean, it's
not many kids want to write for an orchestra.
But you know what?
I mean,
but there are some who do.
Yeah, of course.
There are some who do.
Rob, that's a really good point.
Oh, I know. I know. I felt that while it was coming out.
Okay, put your good point away, would you?
I was in Nashville, and I got to go to two studios. One was Blackbird, and the other was the Sound Kitchen. And I tell you, there was just something really kind of cool, especially when we went to the Sound Kitchen, because they were, you know, several different bands were recording at the time or mixing. I mean, not just one, several. And there was just a great vibe walking through the hall and hearing little muffled sound coming out of this studio and a little muffled sound coming out of that studio.
They'd actually blown the tweeters.
No, but you're so right in the fact that going to a place and having to perform, it kind of, you know, you can capture that performance.
Like anything, yes. Like, and I hope you gave him credit tonight.
I will give Andrew credit tonight.
I'm just telling you. No, I'm kidding. But like anybody, like Andrew right now, he's less relaxed out of all of us because he's sitting there watching the monitor because he's recording this, his performance this evening. Yeah. You know, if you're in a studio, you're playing your piano, you're playing your guitars, yeah, we're all playing everything. We're like, oh, I don't want to screw up for you guys. For 3 minutes, I've got to concentrate. That's what I got into the business for. Like,
yeah, there's nothing like that.
Let's perform. Let's challenge ourselves. Not
you know what,
not
though?
Say, oh, I'll fix it later.
But you can do that in your living room with Pro Tools too. It's a mindset thing. It's purely the mindset.
But it's
a lot more fun in a real studio.
But yeah, and would you want to sit there by yourself? And needless to say, you are by yourself. So you stick on a drum loop or you program the drums yourself, and then that's that thing. And then all of a sudden, it's just you, and you feeling all the same on one track. It's like, eh.
But that's
like masturbation, really.
Yeah, this was
great. I'll have to edit that out. Well, hey, listen, why? We're gonna have to wrap this up here, but. I just want to thank Morgan for coming down and being our guest today. Yeah. Let's give Morgan a hand.
And I have a question. Where can we see your stuff? It's fascinating.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I'm sitting going, well, I want to see these.
Well,
I know you can buy the Hank Williams on Amazon.
You can buy a bunch of them. Netflix has a few of them. You know, I know Muddy Waters and Hank are on Netflix, or you know, Amazon has a bunch of them.
Is it in rotation in any of the cable networks at all?
The Muddy Waters documentary is re-airing on American Masters on PBS this month. May 25th, I think.
Okay,
great. And also, I'll put links up on the webpage to Morgan's website, and you can see all his credits there, and you can look them down because they're really good. If you get a chance to see any of them,
I seen the Brill Birding one. I think I vaguely remember seeing it.
Yeah, that was for A&E. It's on A&E.
A&E, exactly. Yeah. I did see that one.
Cool.
Exactly.
But, you know, I wanted to bring him on because as we go on and start talking technology in these next podcasts and we, you know, start just the musical journey that we're all going down, I think it's really great to look back and just to kind of see, A, the things that are different about how they made music back then, but more importantly, what are the similarities in between how they created music and how music is still being created. So I think we've accomplished that pretty good. All right. Well, you guys, you want to plug anything? Anybody working on anything they want to plug?
I think we should all just plug Andrew. this is the third podcast where he hasn't gotten a
That's
plug.
Right.
Let's
absolutely.
Let's blow him up real big.
Well, this, and we're talking about I actually do the mix down, so you're giving me trouble. But we're talking about Andrew Chavone, who is our engineer every night that we do these podcasts. So he's doing a great job. Here's to Andrew.
Yay! Yay! Oh, he's crying now. Go.
All right. Well,
I forgot Mike had to mix this thing. From now on, let's all do our talking. Well,
that's why it sucks.
We talk. You're talking about Mike.
All right. Well, before it gets really out of control, this is Mike Rodriguez along with Scott, Bobby, Rob, and Morgan, but not Martin Page.
Well, I'd just like to say goodbye for Martin Page.
Saying goodnight, and we'll see you next time.
See you all.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio.